As a parent, I can manipulate my children in becoming people who keep me looking good, who make me impressive to the outside world. But there's something I cannot do. I cannot make my children impressive to God.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a teacher at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. By training, Jack is a philosopher, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced for over 20 years in California and Oregon. Along with her husband Larry, she is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Christianity at Work in Relationships, Jack and Christine discuss how God teaches us to trust Him through the experiences of everyday life. Here now are Jack and Christine.
So after having spent a lot of weeks in looking at basic biblical concepts to help people read their Bibles and understand what's being said, we're now going back to looking at relationships. And so we're at Christianity at Work and Relationships again. The topic that we've chosen to start with today is parenting. And I don't think Jack and I are either one of us experts in this field. I don't think anybody is. I don't think we'll ever be, because being a parent, Jack's going, oh, yeah. Being a parent is really a very, very difficult thing. In fact, I remember being a very young parent with my first child, Jack, and going to some kind of a MOPS meeting, mothers of preschoolers, or I don't know, he was a baby, so maybe he was even younger. But I remember just feeling so overwhelmed and so glad that there was this women's group that's going to get together, and all these women came dressed really well, looking really great. None of us had our kids with us. We were just getting together. I didn't know the women, and I felt like, oh my gosh, I'm in the wrong group. This is just, these people are together, and I feel like I'm just ripping apart at the seams, because parenting has become, it's just so hard for me. The baby's always crying. I'm always getting up in the middle of the night. I'm always tired. I remember being sick and my baby just climbing all over me in bed. I just couldn't do anything. I was just absolutely at loose ends. And I was sitting on the couch at about the end of the meeting, and there was a conversation going on between two women just a few feet away from me. One woman said to another, "You know what? I just feel like I'm underwater. In fact, it feels like there's rapids. And I'm trying to go upstream, and all I do is knock my toe on the rocks and fall over. They're bloody. I go downstream. I get up. I try to go upstream." And she was explaining this to this other woman, and I just went, oh, yes, that's exactly how I feel. And it was so comforting to have somebody say that, to be real about it. And that's what I hope we can accomplish here today, is to let people kind of breathe a sigh of relief, somewhat like I did, understanding that it isn't just hard for me, but it's hard for everybody out there.
Yeah, one of the things that is most perverse about attitudes that creep into the Christian community and into our thinking as Christians is the notion that, and we've talked about this before, but the notion that the reason I became a Christian and I cast in my lot with Jesus is so that He would make my life go better. And one of those areas where we most want help, we'll most desperately need help, is in parenting. And so the notion comes into our community that now that I'm a Christian, if I'll just study my Bible and learn the principles and learn that wisdom that the Bible teaches me about how to be a good parent, then I will do this parenting thing with ease and successfully, and I will be victorious as a parent. And I just think that's a really damnable lie. It is not only a lie with respect to parenting, but so much else of our life, that becoming a Christian doesn't make things easier. It puts them in perspective. It helps me understand a larger picture. It helps me be at rest in the midst of chaos and turmoil and grief and sorrow and disappointment, but it doesn't take it away. And I think you're right. Probably the most important message that we can communicate is, if you feel like you're drowning, it's because you are. in a sense.
And other people around you are drowning.
And they are as well.
You're not alone. But I think we're pretty invested in looking like we're not drowning.
Yeah.
And having that perception, I think that's what I got when I went to that meeting. Whether or not they were trying to communicate it, I don't know at that particular meeting. But boy, they sure looked together, and it was very discouraging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's two things at play there. I mean, I think in the best of cultures, we would be invested in looking good and looking in control and looking on top of things. But then when you add to that the sociological dynamic of a Christian community that is reinforcing the notion that you better be together in this regard, it makes it all the more powerful a message, a wrong message. That as Christians we don't struggle, as Christians we don't feel defeat, as Christians we don't ever get perplexed and confused and nonplussed and not know what to do, because in Jesus we always know the right answer. Well, when we're constantly surrounded by that kind of message that our culture is giving to us, that it takes a lot of wisdom and a lot of strength on my part to stand up and say, that's not true in my life. It's not what I'm experiencing.
And it takes a lot, and I think we're kind of ousted.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think, Jack, that some people really feel like they're not being defeated. I think that, for example, if I can be a parent that can be very controlling of my children, if I can get them to really stay in line, I've heard many stories, but one I'm thinking of in this regard is a military family had several kids, I think perhaps six kids, and these kids were really, really in control. They would go into a restaurant, and the restaurant owner would say, wow, it's great to have your family here, even though there's so many of you, because you are so well-behaved. The parents would get compliments all the time. But the bottom line was that these kids were being completely controlled. They were not allowed to get out of line, kind of like being in the military. And so what it did is it made the parents' life really kind of easy. Mm-hmm. They had the older ones take care of the younger ones. They had militaristic rules. They really didn't have much leeway for the kids to develop their own sense of self, to think independently, to grow up and mature in those ways. But they were reflecting positively on the parents. The parents also were not really challenged that much if they could just keep this law and order. And I think from that kind of parenting, it feels like it's not so hard. I think later we need to reflect on what is the goal of parenting. If that is the goal of parenting, to just have your kids be in line, then they were really successful. If the goal of parenting is something else, they were failing miserably.
Right.
But they had an easier job where they didn't feel defeated, maybe tired, but they were doing it right. I have an uncle that told me the way that you raise kids, and I think he's serious. He says you raise kids the way you raise dogs. You get them to be obedient, and man, his dogs are obedient. He and I go head to head, as you quite imagine.
As he tries to break your will.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he's really frustrated. He can't quite get there. Poor guy. He's got a formidable task.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly the problem, is that we have to be clear on the goal of parenting. Is the goal of parenting to have little trophy children, or is the goal of parenting, which is really all about me, is fulfilling a kind of worldly and selfish desire on my part, or is the goal of parenting to be a steward of their little souls before my own creator?
So the question,
and I think
is,
it's the latter.
Yeah, absolutely. And the question is, how do I be a steward of their souls?
and that's what I have no answers to.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
You know what? Before we go on, let's talk a little bit about our own selves in terms of the kids that we have, and then we'll go back to the goal here.
Okay.
I think that might be helpful for people.
Okay. I have four children. They range in ages right now, almost 22.
Jack, you're very old.
Or is it 23? And then almost 21, and almost 18, and 15. And it's three girls and a boy. The second one is a boy, and the other three are girls.
Wow, Shelby is 15?
Yeah.
That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
I know I sound old. Remember when the old people used to come to our house when we were young, and they said, you've grown up so much, dear?
Yeah.
Here we are saying that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay, so you have your 20, almost 23-year-old is out of college now.
Yes, she'll be going to graduate school to become a teacher.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Secondary?
Elementary school, probably.
Okay, so that would be Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then Tyler is the 21-year-old, and he's perhaps a junior in college?
He's just finishing his sophomore year.
Okay, and then...
Morgan is...
Graduating.
Graduating from high school this year and will be in college next fall.
And where's she going?
She's going to Oregon State University.
Up in Corvallis.
In Corvallis, Oregon.
Okay. Is she going to play soccer up there?
Yes, she is.
Mm-hmm. She got a scholarship?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah.
And Shelby would be like a junior in
She'll
high
be a sophomore, actually, next year.
Okay. Okay.
What about
you came from a family of five boys,
six boys? Six boys. I had five brothers.
Oh, man. Congratulations to your mom. Good job, Lenore. She always listens to these, so hi, Lenore. Okay. I have three children, and Jesse, who's 18, Jordan, who's 15, and Leah, who's almost 11. We put all our kids into kindergarten a year late, so my 18-year-old has one more year of high school. And I came from a family of four kids. I'm the second, and three girls, and then a boy at the very end. Where are you in your birth order?
Oops, I have to count. Four. I'm fourth. Fourth out of the six.
Okay. All right. So that's us. I think we have a lot of experience. I said earlier in the show that we're not experts, but between us we have a lot of experience. I think particularly experience in humility and defeat for me.
Yeah, me too.
A lot of trial and error and a lot of real humbling through recognizing that these people I either could, going back to the goal, I could either really try and control and make them, as you said, trophies for myself, or try and help them develop their own sense of self. And, it's a wild card. Don't know exactly what they're going to say or how it's going to come out or what they're going to do, but very, very committed to trying to help them become their own people who can make their own decisions, make their own choices, think independently, develop their own, sense of self again. I want them to mature. I want them ultimately to make the decision of what do they want their life to be about, not based on something that they're thinking someone else wants them to do, but based on an internal heart belief in what they're doing and where they're going. And that happens in all areas of life. That's what I want in all areas of life. But most particularly, of course, I want them to want God. And they could act like they want God. They could want God because they're afraid of what I might think or someone else might think or what the church or the culture might think. Or they could want God because they want God from their heart. That's what I want. And I think that's, to me, what would be a steward of their soul.
Yeah, absolutely. In my responsibilities as a tutor at Gutenberg College, I've just read a bunch of Kierkegaard recently. Kierkegaard was a Danish Christian philosopher from Denmark in the last century, a brilliant Christian thinker. I really appreciate his stuff. And he had an essay where he was talking about the self and talking about the impossibility of having a sense of self, if you will, without relating to God. And it was a very, very profound essay. And that's ultimately what God has put me responsible for, is to try to do everything I can to introduce my children to God, because in introducing my children to God, I'm giving them that real, genuine, profound sense of self that you were talking about.
So I think a question that people would have is, so how do I introduce my children to God?
Well, I think the most important thing of all is I can't very well introduce my children to God if I don't know God. So the absolutely the top priority for me is to work on my own knowledge of God. I need to come to know Him. If I'm so foolish that I don't care about knowing God, I'm in no position to help guide my children in that regard. So I think that's absolutely number one. The most important thing I can do is make sure that I'm pursuing my own love of God and knowledge of God. Then from there, I would say that, and I speak from my own experience as a child, and I think where my parents were most successful in my life is through the example of their life. It wasn't so much what they said to me and what they taught me. It was more the way they lived, what their values were, what character they showed. That was worth 10,000 words. You know, one decision made out of integrity was worth 10,000 sermons on integrity to me. And that had, a really powerful impact on my life, because I just saw, really, ultimately, I couldn't escape how beautiful it was to be a good person, to be a person of integrity, even if it cost you. But then, beyond that...
No, let's stay there for a minute. I think I'm going, because on one hand, in the beginning of the show, we were saying, we as parents are going to fail a lot. We're going to be defeated a lot. We're going to struggle a lot. We're not mm-hmm. going to do it right. And yet, now you're talking about your parents, who sounds like they did it right.
Well,
that we need to do it right.
It's not
and
that
I don't think that's what you're saying exactly, but let's clarify.
Yeah, it's not that they are not flawed people. I mean, I think everybody on the face of the planet is a flawed person. So they are not unflawed, and I am not unflawed. And so that's hopeless if we have to be perfect specimens of humanity. But integrity involves admitting that I'm flawed, acknowledging my failures before my children. I mean, it's really hard for a parent to go to a child and with humility that undergo the humiliation of saying to your own child, who's smaller than you are and who you could easily intimidate if you wanted to and chose to, you can intimidate them so much that you can have them thinking that your view of reality is reality when they can see that that's obviously not the case, and have them believing you instead of their own eyes. I mean, that's how powerful a parent can be toward their children. Integrity is to go to that child who you could easily intimidate and say, you know what? What you're seeing is true. I really am selfish here. I really am being proud here. I really am being cruel here. I really am being thoughtless here. And I don't like what I am. I don't like the fact that I'm behaving this way. Would you forgive me? Well, that's a fundamental underlying kind of integrity, because I'm committed to what's true. I'm committed to what's right. I can't always perform in the light of what's true and what's right, but it's not for lack of commitment. It's not for lack of that being what my life is really all about and what I want it to be all about. But it has to manifest itself in confession of sin rather than in flawless performance, because I'm a sinner who can't flawlessly perform.
So that's one of those examples of integrity that you're talking about.
Exactly, yeah.
That your parents might have demonstrated. A mm-hmm. humility to point it out when they were wrong, and not to distort the reality of the child by claiming something that wasn't true.
I can remember, I have a very vivid recollection of something my father would say on a number of occasions, where something would be happening in life, and I don't even remember the details. I don't remember the specifics, but he was in politics for a while, and when you're in politics, all kinds of slanderous things get said about you, things that are just not even remotely true, but they get said about you. And my dad always sort of took the position that, he didn't really defend himself. Now, in the political arena, he might have tried to set the record straight in some way or another, but he never did lash out at other people and try to undermine them and get back at them and take revenge and that kind of thing. And it would get really frustrating to the rest of the family, and one of us might say something to the effect that well, it really seems foolish to not protect yourself, or, you know, you don't want to be a doormat. And, you know, why would you just be a doormat? And my father's response was always the same. He'd just kind of smile and say, well, from something like this, you know, from my experience, God takes care of us doormats. Well, that always stuck with me, because what it meant was his security, his peace, his rest, the place that he had reached that allowed him to not have to take revenge and to lash out at other people, is that he really was committed to the fact that God would take care of him. God would be his vindicator. God would be his protector. God would defend him, so he didn't need to defend himself. Well, that was a very powerful message for me, that I'm sure had a huge impact on me, that I don't need to take care of myself. I don't need to protect myself. I don't need to protect my reputation. God is the defender of our reputation. Because in real life, that's the integrity that I was talking about. In real life situations where I could see what it was costing him, what it was costing him is he had to absorb all this slander or all of this, you know, manipulation by people behind the scenes. He was being victimized by all that. But instead of protecting himself, he believed in the reality of a God who would protect him, and he believed it so thoroughly that he acted on it. I mean, it's one thing to say in your theology, yes, I believe God exists. It's another thing entirely to believe it so firmly and so clearly that you actually stake your well-being on that. And my dad staked his well-being on that on a number of occasions, and that spoke volumes to me.
It's interesting, Jack. My father, too, was in politics for quite a while, and mostly city politics, and he also was trying to develop Southern California, and you might be aware of, perhaps people would be aware of the Coastal Commission. There was a huge emphasis, I don't know if it's still there, to not develop, and he was a land developer, so he was often in a lot of hot water, and I would watch my father really suffer throughout my growing up time. He would often be misquoted in the newspaper, and he would be very bugged by that and express that somewhat to us. But I never heard him really slander any particular person much. But what he told me was, I don't get mad, Christine. I get even. Hmm. Really quite the opposite of what your father said. That didn't teach me a good thing. There is this belief in him that he can get even and does get even and does it in some pretty strong and powerful ways. But the way he got even is interesting. He was always honest. And he was always straightforward. He was always clear. He was always rather intimidating. But he was able to get his point across without being dishonest. And so although I didn't get from my father a very valuable lesson that you got, I got a different lesson. And it's a very powerful one to me today. I have a strength in my ability to confront and my ability to follow through on what I think is right. Sometimes that's not so great. I fall through so hard, just like being a doormat. If you take it too far, it's really not good, and we could probably talk about either of us a long time at their extremes. They're not good things. But I say that in part, Jack, as an encouragement to parents, because although I think that I have some real strengths and people could look at me and see some of my strengths, I think that also there's a lot of weaknesses in me, as in you, and that's what we're going to be as parents. We're going to have some strengths in some areas that other people don't, and some weaknesses in areas that other people don't, and it's we're just not going to do a really great job, because we're not bringing a perfect person to our parenting. We haven't been able to read the perfect book because it doesn't exist, or do the perfect thing because we can't in our humanity do that. We bring ourselves, and I think that's what we need to really communicate to people, is that we can't divorce ourselves and find a technique that works well. What we do is we bring ourselves, we bring, like you said earlier, our commitment to our relationship to God, or we don't. We bring our commitment to being stewards to our children, or we don't. We bring our commitment to being ethical, moral, loving people, or we don't.
Jody and I read all kinds of books on parenting before our first child came. And I think I've mentioned before, I have four children now. We had an older child from Catherine that died when he was 2 years old.
From so, Catherine, before Catherine was
born.
Yeah,
he was older than Catherine, 2 years before Catherine was born. Before that child came, we read all kinds of books on parenting. And the thing I noticed very quickly is how really largely irrelevant all those things that I had learned were. Not because they were wrong so much. I mean, many of the things that we had read about were really commonsensical and true and were rooted in a biblical worldview. But the problem is, so much of parenting is a spontaneous reaction to a situation. And
it's bringing me, like I said.
Exactly.
Whoever I am, the conglomeration in me
exactly.
shows up.
Because at those times when you're reacting, you don't have time to think, okay, now what did the book say about how I respond in that situation? You're long past that point by the time you remember the books. You've already reacted. You've already responded. You've already interacted with your child. And because that's so much a part of the everyday relationship between a parent and a child, it really comes down to what kind of person am I becoming is really what determines what kind of parent I am, rather than what kind of philosophy have I embraced. Because the philosophy ends up being pretty theoretical and pretty irrelevant and pretty remote to the day-in and day-out interaction between a parent and a child.
It's being a parent is kind of like, I don't know, I've never been on a battlefield, but it kind of makes me think of that right now as we're talking, that a soldier can't go into battle and think, okay, now I crawl. Now I see, what should I do in this situation? Let me check out those 3 points that somebody told me about.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
And the same thing with being a parent. I will automatically respond out of my own heart, out of my own maturity or lack of maturity. That's the bottom line of what's going to happen between myself and my child. And it doesn't matter how great my techniques are. I might have a child that is able to have a few relational skills more than other people if I've really taught him that. But really, my child is going to be a reflection of me. And I think that's what's so difficult about parenting, is that our children become reflections of ourselves and we don't like it. So let's talk about what we do to children when they're reflections of us that we don't like. I think what we do wrongly, and we've kind of hit on that some already, but when our children become a reflection that we don't like, we try to change them.
Oh, I see. How are we likely to respond?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
What do we do wrong?
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's mostly what we do.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. That's the incredible temptation in parenting, is to forget that God is their creator, and God has made the child to be whom God has made the child to be. We easily get tempted into thinking, I am their creator. Oh boy, here is this laboratory, and God has given me all the raw materials to fashion somebody into my image, not like me, but like I would want to be, like I want them to be, that trophy that I want them to become. I have the opportunity to fashion them. And I just think that's a huge, perverse mistake that we make, because God is their creator. God has determined their life, their character, their destiny, everything about them. My job is to be a steward of nurturing that creature God has made to be who God wants them to be. And whenever I work against that by trying to refashion them and recreate them into the one I want them to be, that's an incredibly presumptuous attitude on my part. But it's so natural to us. I mean, it just comes so easily.
So let's have some examples of how we do that in our real lives, Jack.
Go ahead.
Well, I've heard you talk about one of your children being very much different than the other three.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been really a struggle for you. Is it a struggle in this regard?
Yes, absolutely. Because everything in me wants me to make that child model my personal values. And for whatever reason, God has given me a child that is naturally attracted to everything that I hold in contempt.
Okay, so I'm thinking you don't really enjoy kind of appearances. Appearances
right.
aren't important to you, so
right.
they may be important to this child.
Exactly.
Okay, so having a lot of stuff isn't very important to you. Stuff, clothes, makeup, something like that. Cars
yes.
may be important to this child.
Right. And so, you know, what I'm faced with is, now on the one hand, and here's the balancing act, on the one hand is a fascination with appearance a spiritual problem? Could be. Is it a moral problem? Could be. So I do need to counterbalance this tendency of this child, because it's a potential weakness that could be crippling. So I do need to try to find a way to teach her, to guide her in a healthy direction, morally and spiritually healthy direction on the one hand. On the other hand...
Wait a minute, let me be a devil's advocate.
Okay.
It also could be that a person who doesn't have enough, who avoids looking at appearance at all, could also have a moral or spiritual
problem. Oh, absolutely,
problem.
Sure.
And
yeah.
so it's sometimes with our children we can think, okay, they're really doing it wrong, but it might be that they're just these little people in our lives to help us question our own values, our own decision-making.
Yeah, that...
And help bring more richness into our lives in that regard.
Right, that's the challenge, is that to what extent are my values moral values,
mm-hmm.
and to what extent are they personal values?
Right.
Just sort of personal taste, personal preference, my own self-concept, a part of my own self-concept, and so on. And it's so easy to blur those.
We don't really usually blur them. We usually think this is a moral issue, not a personal.
Well, that's what I mean. We identify them.
Yeah.
We think that my values are the only moral values in the world. Everybody should have my values.
Right.
And it's part of wisdom to be able to see that that's not the case, and to be able to begin to sort out, as even though I feel just as strongly about my personal values as I do about moral values, can I, Jack, have the objectivity to begin to distinguish between them,
mm-hmm.
and recognize that different people have different tastes, they're different people, they're different personalities, they have different styles of attacking this world and reality, and they really are valid people, valid human beings, even though they're not you.
Mm-hmm.
When that's your own child, I mean, it's a lot easier with a stranger. Yeah, I'll let them be who they are. And I don't have to identify with them. I don't have to take any responsibility for them. They can be that way if they want to. When it's your own child, the temptation is very, very strong to want to instill your personal values in them. I want you to like this. I want you to have this kind of these tastes. I want you to be this sort of person.
Mm-hmm.
And here God is up in heaven saying, but I didn't make them that person, Jack. Yes, it's your child, but they're not you. They're not like you. And there's the balancing act of, on the one hand, recognizing the pitfalls of the personality that they have, where that can go wrong, where that can become perverse, where that can go the wrong direction. And it is my responsibility to try to steer them away from the pitfalls, but it's not my responsibility to change them, to make them me.
And I think what we're coming into is it's really easy or to live in a home where the kid is more like you.
Yeah, it can, yeah.
It's just, you know, it's a lot smoother. This square peg in a round hole doesn't really fit very well. And so to kind of make life a little bit easier, also just in the home, just nice to have them more like you.
Mm-hmm. And I see myself failing in that regard constantly. I'll make little sarcastic, catty comments that are calculated to try to undermine what's important to her, because that's just cruel. I mean, there's mm-hmm. nothing instructive about that. There's nothing edifying about that. There's nothing loving about that. It's one thing to have a heart-to-heart talk to talk about the pitfalls, but that's more typically I just get sarcastic, and that's hurtful, biting, damaging. There's nothing right about that.
What do you think the sarcasm is about?
Well, because I'm threatened. You know, I don't understand as well somebody who's different from me. I don't understand why they like what they like. I don't understand why they have those values. And I feel threatened by that, and I feel scared, I imagine, a little bit, in any case, uncomfortable with it. And so I would prefer that they not have those values. And my sarcasm is about manipulating them, if I could, into being a different person.
So you don't have to be intimidated or scared.
Yeah, exactly.
So what we do is we make it about us. And I just was asking that question, not because, you know, oh, Jack, you know, you do this uniquely. But all of us really come out of intimidation or fear or something that is uncomfortable for us. And out of that, we want to change our children rather than out of their best interest.
Yeah, because they're making my life psychologically and emotionally uncomfortable.
Right, right. And if they could just smooth out and be like I am, do it the way I think is right, then my life is going to be more comfortable.
Right.
And that's the worst, the most selfish thing that we could do to another person. And what we do on top of it is we convince them often that it isn't my selfishness that I'm trying to... it's not out of selfishness that I'm doing this and not out of trying to quell my own fears, but because it's in your best interest. Well, that's a bunch of baloney. Mm-hmm. It isn't in their best interest, and we're not loving them at all. And I think a real red flag is things like your sarcasm,
mm-hmm.
Impatience, being critical of the child. It isn't then about them and their best interest. It's about me and what I want to do to avoid what's scary to me.
And contempt. I mean, if I don't say a word, but I, mm-hmm. but I know when I'm feeling that contempt.
Mm-hmm.
That's a red flag.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's something else going on then. This love does not hold other people in contempt. It just doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can say that I've been, and probably all of us have been, on both sides of the barrel with this. I both have experienced from my family their desire to change me, to make me different than who I am. And I also have done that with my own children. And I think we can be really blind to the fact that we're doing that. I'll tell you a story. I'm going to... tell a story of my dad again, but it was very recent. Recently, I went on vacation and really actually had a great time, went and visited my dad. He lives out in Texas, and really had a very delightful time with him, one of the best I've ever had, so I was really, really grateful for that trip. My dad has tended to be rather critical of me, hasn't liked the choices that I've made, and doesn't tend to appreciate my straightforwardness, that I won't back down on things, that I really push the point, that I'm pretty strong-willed in that regard. And he was telling this something like this to my husband actually last year, and they're driving around, and my husband Larry says, "You know what, Bernard? The problem is that Christine is most like you than any other of your children. It's just that the things that she stands up for are very different than the things that you stand up for." And I just thought that was such a clear statement on my husband's part. My dad has really not liked me to be who I am, and yet I'm very much the person that he is, and yet it is different values, and so it's very difficult for him to see that I'm doing something that he really likes. And I think out of his own discomfort with the values that I hold and the lifestyle that I choose, that he wants to change me. It was very interesting, though, on this trip that I recently took, there was a relative who owns a very historic home that has been in my family for many years. It is the coolest thing. Someday it should be a museum. It's old and has these murals on the wall and that my great-grandfather did. And anyway, it's just a very, very cool place. And my uncle now owns it. And before he died, he told my dad, "I want your family to have this this home, and I want to make it available to you." Well, he died a couple of months after that. And the person who is now passed down to is kind of reluctant to then sell it to our family. And so we were walking, the last day we were walking down by that house, and the people who now own it happened to be there. And we didn't expect them, and we just went in to say hi. And this is a relative of mine, and I was excited to see them. It's in Texas, so I'm not around very much. So I walked into the house, and I said hi, you know, and hugged them, sat down, kind of have this nice little chat right before I climb on the airplane, basically. And my dad sits down, and he goes, "Now, so-and-so, I don't want to say their name, I'd like to talk to you about this house. Now, before he died, my brother said that this house should go to us," and just kind of really hit very straight, and this person would come up with an argument, and he just plowed it down and come up with another argument and he plowed it down. And I'm just sitting there holding on to my seat. I thought we were going to have this little nice conversation, you know, with somebody I haven't seen in 5 years, and he is just coming at it. And it was such a reminder of how much my dad is like me. I will do exactly that in situations where I feel very strongly. And he walks out, and I said, "Oh, boy, Dad, that was really tough. Why'd you do that?" And he goes, "Well, Christine, what you got to do in life is you just got to hit things straight on, and you've got to confront things, and you know." And he's just going down the line, and I thought, you know, I'm doing the same thing to him. He was pushing through with something that he thought was really very important, and out of my discomfort, I just wanted to run out of there, you know, if I could have. And so it is, I guess my point is, our discomfort rises up and becomes the beam that we follow. It becomes the light that we follow, not the light, the thing that we follow, rather than looking at what's in the best interest of the other person. I wanted to change him, he's wanted to change me, you wanted to change your daughter, and yet all those things have come out of a selfishness, out of a desire not to be uncomfortable ourselves.
Right. What's the antidote to that?
Go to heaven.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, you know, I think you have an answer in mind.
Well, and short of that is to trust God with the discomfort, to let him resolve it in his way, in his time. And our problem is we don't believe enough in the reality of God to be able to do that. That's what we have to do, is to come to a point where we really believe that I have a creator, an author of my own being, who knows exactly what he's doing, knows that I'm uncomfortable, knows that he's put me in this position, and the response I have to learn to make is, "God, this is not fun, but you're doing something, and I'll wait and see what that is." And that doesn't make the discomfort go away, but it allows me to accept it. It allows me to accept the fact that God just doesn't want me to be as happy as I would like to be right now.
In a sense, it's embracing the discomfort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's allowing it to be a part of my life and sitting in it. And lots of times I tell people that. They say, "Wait a minute, I just feel miserable." Well, yeah, sometimes I just have to feel miserable. Or I'm, in this case with my children, making them miserable. Making them become little robots, little people that reflect something good on me or make me feel a little bit more comfortable, rather than being a steward of their individual soul. Mm-hmm. But let's back up a little bit. Yeah, I really agree with us that we need to trust God, that he's got something in mind, and that we need to embrace the pain. We need to grieve what we're losing, what we'd rather have. But even before that, Jack, we have to even know that we're doing it. And I think we've hit upon some of that, and I'd like to underline it again. If we see ourselves, as you said, contemptuous, if we see ourselves being angry or sarcastic or impatient or hurtful toward our child, wanting them to change, we need to look at those as red flags. Oftentimes, though, as we said before, we don't look at those as red flags. Instead, we say, this is something that's a moral issue, that they need to be this way. And we don't take the time, which we need to say, is this a moral issue? Or is this a personal issue? Is this something that's just making me uncomfortable? Or is it something that's ultimately right? And then if I think that it's right, I still need to be open to, maybe it isn't the morally right thing to do. Maybe what
I'm
my
sorry, back up, you say, if you decide that it is a moral issue, did you say?
I don't know. Did I get confusing there? If I decide that it is a moral issue, I still need to be open to maybe it was a personal issue. I think as a parent, I need to keep flexible. I need to keep working with new information, and not to be jelly-like, but to be a person who's willing to be teachable in the same way that I want my children
to be
teachable.
So you mean I need to be humble enough to know that even if I have concluded with a certain kind of confidence, no, I really think this is a moral issue, to have enough humility to know, but I may be wrong about that.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
yeah.
And I think that's a huge part of parenting.
Yeah.
Have the humility to be willing to say, maybe I'm not right here.
Yeah.
And to have the information that's coming into me always be something that I'm willing to look at again and again and again. But I can't really say, okay, I'm just going to be uncomfortable with this if I don't even have any clue that I am uncomfortable. If I just, as most of us parents do, make the child wrong and tell them in whatever way to change by being intimidating, intimidation can come through me just being a total victim, a person that's threatening that I might get sick if they go against what I want, or I might get weak, or my life might get hurt in some way. I might be intimidating in the sense that I'm angry or big or loud or, you know, forceful. I could be passive aggressive in my approach to them to try and get them to do what I want them to do. All of those things are huge, and many, many more are huge ways that I try, strategies that I use to try ultimately to make myself comfortable and to stay away from my discomfort by changing my child, by getting my child to do whatever it is that brings me most comfort. That makes sense?
Right. Yeah, it does.
So that's, I think if people don't quite follow what we're saying, I think it's tough to follow this. We are psychologically pretty pretty adept at getting what we want and then
rationalizing it
big time. And we can particularly do that with children because we have power over children. We've got the height. Actually, I don't have the height anymore. My daughter asked me to put ribbons in her hair, and I said, wait a minute, let me step on top of this step and then look down. She's almost even with me now, or getting there. So, yeah, we don't have that. But early on, we have a lot of physical power over our children. We have a lot more smarts, usually. We're in a position in society that really supports us. There's a lot of privacy that we can create. We have the money bag. So there's a lot of ways in which we can power over our children. And so to not do that is an act of courage. It's a commitment to doing what's right, consciously working toward that, making mistakes in doing it, and coming back and saying, I did that wrong.
Right. Just in the couple minutes we have left, let me hitchhike on something you were saying earlier. Another thing to keep in mind is that it would be in making this distinction between whether it's a moral issue or just a personal value and wanting to guide them into wisdom but not recreate them into an image of my own personal values. We really have to understand that extends right down to the most important issue of all, and that is their faith, their obedience to God, their wisdom itself. We, back to our weeks and weeks of earlier discussion, wisdom is not something that I can coerce another person into. It's something that they have to embrace from inside themselves, from their own heart. And I cannot and I will never be able to make that happen. No way. I could make them fake it. You know, I could make them look externally like they have done that. But that's not the real, authentic faith. That's not real, authentic
wisdom.
And
might not even
know
that they're faking it.
And they may not know it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's very important to keep that in mind, because otherwise, you know, we really get frightened for our children. You know, what if they're not saved? You know, what if they're not going to go to heaven? What if they're not going to have eternal life? And we can panic and despair and decide, okay, I'll make it happen. And that's probably the worst thing I could ever do is attempt to sanctify my children through intimidation and coercion. That's the absolute worst.
And ultimately, I think your point is underneath is we can't make that happen.
No. Uh-uh.
We can't coerce them into it. We can coerce them into something that might look like that, but we can't coerce them into the reality of that. And so bottom line, even if we can get our kids to look good, to keep us from feeling uncomfortable, we cannot ultimately give them what's most important, or give us what's most important, which is the salvation of our children.
Right. I can make them into people that might impress other people, but I can't make them into people that are going to impress God. And I just, that's just a fact that I better face, because and it'll change the way I treat my kids. There are just a lot of people who think I can make my children into children who will be impressive to God. And there's all kinds of damage they do and all kinds of destruction that they wreak out of that assumption.
Most of the time, our relationship to our culture is like a fish to water. It is as though we are swimming in our culture. It surrounds us everywhere we go, and it can have a profound impact on the way we think and the values we hold. Because of its collective nature, culture can create momentum for ideas and beliefs, evil as well as good. In his News and Views article, Culture, Friend or Foe, Mackenzie Study Center teacher Wes Hurd takes on the question of how should a Christian live in a post-Christian world. Wes argues that all too often the church is more aware of modern, non-Christian points of view and how they are biased against the biblical worldview than it is about its own cultural assumptions, which are much closer and often more damaging to its life. As believers, we need to know the truth of the gospel, and this includes understanding how the culture we live in can distort the gospel message and feed it back to us in ways that might seem to make sense. However, in this post-Christian world, we may have even more opportunities to share the gospel with others in fresh and meaningful ways. Call Mackenzie and ask for your copy of Wes Hurd's Culture, Friend or Foe.
One of the series that has been really valuable to people, we've gotten a lot of requests for, is the singleness series. In fact, Jack, some of the people who have ordered the singleness tapes have said, wow, this is just as good for marriage. And in fact, sometimes when people want to hear about marriage, I'll give them the singleness tapes, even before our marriage tapes, because they, I think they really did hit at some core issues. People who have been really helped by our ministry have sometimes sent in donations. And we certainly appreciate that. We covet your consideration of supporting us, supporting this program so that we can continue to broadcast it. We have, the last couple of weeks, tried to read some of the letters that people have sent who have been appreciative of the program, who have who are supporting it, and who just have expressed their interest. So here's just a short letter. Please let Christine and Jack know what a blessing their program is to so many of us in Northern California. Christianity at Work is truly a unique ministry. As others have expressed before, Jack and Christine address so many issues that so many of God's children are afraid or ashamed to discuss. Please know I will continue to pray for your broadcast ministry. One thing she says here is that Christianity at Work is truly a unique ministry, and what we tried to do when we started this ministry was to not make it like everything else, but to try and, through our discussion format and through the discussion of issues in our own lives, and through a thorough look at the scriptures, that we can offer something that is unique and especially helpful to people in a world where there's few answers and a lot of questions. And once again, to continue this broadcast ministry that we are thoroughly delighted to be doing and thoroughly grateful, and I think for both of us, humbled for the opportunity. We do ask you guys to consider thinking about if you want to contribute financially, and do it today. Think about it today and consider sending in a contribution.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mackenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of Mackenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.